Okay, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. I was told that there would be lots of questions, so we should get started on this, the last part of today's session. I'm afraid our table would probably flunk. We had so many other questions to ask Sergio that we never got to the question he gave us. So I don't know what the consequences of that will be. Now, I have a few announcements to make before we resume things. Now that our own provincial election is past us, political aficionados can still look south to the campaign that never seems to end. In light of this, next week's speaker is Peter McCormick, who's with the Department of Political Science at the University of Lethbridge. And I was just given a new title. It's called The Obama Phenomenon. So how come Americans get to have all the fun? So, let's see, two other announcements is that today's session is part of an internationally recognized Brain Awareness Week. There will be a free public lecture tonight at the Yates Theater at 7 o'clock. The speaker will be Dr. Ian Wishaw, and his title is, So, How Does the Brain Work? So I believe that Naomi Kramer, who is the person who keeps the things moving at the Department of Neuroscience, she works extremely long hours to do this. I believe she put a little flyer on each table, and otherwise, come over to us. We have information on that. And the other event is that the Department of Neuroscience, Canadian Center for Behavioral Neuroscience, is hosting an open house on Saturday. There's a tour at 10 o'clock and 1 o'clock. I'm looking at her. I believe everyone's welcome. And I think they have to sign up ahead. Is that right, Naomi?
Okay. The phone number to respond to is right on this.
Okay, so check the flyer. And, oh, there's some students over there from the department, so lots of people to answer questions. Okay, then, let's get back to today's topic. Which is rough and tumble play and the development of social competency, in case we have anyone who stumbled into the room. Our presenter is Dr. Sergio Pellis. And I want to ask, questioners need to come up to the podium, and I'd like to ask you to keep your comments and questions brief, to be considerate for lots of other people who also have questions. And I guess that's all I need to say.
Hi, my name is Knut Peterson. Thanks very much for giving us some insight. I just wonder if you could tell us where rough and tumble play ends and where bullying starts.
Excellent question, and I'm sure that has been something that occurred to most of you as you were hearing me talk. It's gone off. Hello?
Also, if you have a question, we can form a little bit of a queue back here.
Sounds like a big one. Hello? Yes. Okay, so that's actually a very good question. And remember I said that one of the cardinal features of rough and tumble play is ambiguity. And indeed, you can imagine that some people when they, or some rats, some people, some monkeys, when they engage in play, will capitalize on that ambiguity and make it rougher than the other person may actually like, or the other rat may actually like. And that would be a transition into bullying. I can illustrate that with an example from my own history. I went from elementary school into a technical school. This was in Australia. You're very established that I'm an Australian. But I am a Canadian as well. I went to a pretty rough technical school, and as one of the new kids, well, I was an easy mark for gangs of tougher older kids. And they had this habit of catching young kids like me, throwing you on the ground, on your back, pinning you down by your shoulders, and then smacking you on your chest like this, yelling out, rats in your face. It was rather prophetic since I ended up studying rats, but that's another story. Anyway, what could I do about it? Not very much. Pretty much, the kid was about at least a third bigger than me, I'm sitting there, I'm having to take it, and if I didn't smile and look like I was being playful, he just would hit me more. Clearly, that transgressed that line. So somehow, what you need to do in order to establish whether that line's been transgressed is whether both participants are finding it positively rewarding. Is this pleasurable for both members of that plain dyad? If one of them finds it no longer pleasurable, then clearly it's no longer play for them. And this is hard to tell. If you know the animals very, very well, sometimes you can tell where one animal's made the transgression. If you can measure things going on in the brain, sometimes you can figure out where the transgression is. But that is a gray zone that adds to the complexity of deciding, am I going to let that keep happening or not? So it is a good question. Thank you.
I think I forgot to ask you to state your name before you ask a question.
My name is Van Christou. I couldn't help thinking while you were giving that very interesting address that there's enough white-haired people around in this room amongst the young students that are here, including myself, the white-haired people, that we've seen a great change in the behavior of play amongst children in our time. I think that with the advent of technology and all the changes that are technological changes that are coming in, with the amount of time that young people, children, are spending in front of TV tubes and monitors on computers playing games, that it's isolating them from other children in a major way, where they're not roughhousing as much, they're not playing games as much. They're not whittling on sticks as much, or all the other things that children used to do, whatever it was. Don't you think that your research will be a great advantage in pointing this out to people, that we might be able to reverse some of this trend in our society?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I can't disagree with that. Indeed, I think that's absolutely true, and in fact this morning I run a seminar class that looks at the problem of play, and the students and I were all engaged in this discussion about that very issue. Can some of these technological things really substitute for the kind of roughhousing that I was talking about today? And the general consensus was, even if they can a little bit, not completely, you say you still are missing things out. And there are a couple of international bodies that have been trying to return or give back the opportunity to children to engage in more traditional games that they initiate rather than is prepared by them by toy companies or by teachers or whatever. And I certainly hope that some of the work that we've done contributes to legitimizing that return to offering kids that opportunity. Thank you.
Philip Butterfield, Dr. Pellis, I found your subject very fascinating. I have a number of questions. There's rough and tumble, and there's play. Now, the only way I suppose that rats can play is rough and tumble, if indeed that is playing, if we're not anthropomorphizing, but anyway, they go through these motions of rough and tumble. Now, when you transpose what you find there to human beings, are you sure you're just talking about rough and tumble or friendly rivalry? Rats can't play chess, for instance. And because if human beings play chess or have other forms of intellectual rivalry, competition, was that the same thing as rough and tumble, or is there something essential to your study and the analogy that relies on physical rough and tumble? Is it a physical thing that counts, or is it rivalry, Or is it just getting together for humans, if playing chess or watching television, for instance, together? Does that count rather than watching television alone? And so on. There's, in other words, I'm saying there's a lot to be asked about the analogy, about any likeness between the rats and humans in just those ways that I've suggested.
Well, the short answer is yes to all the above. You're absolutely correct in everything you said. If you're a rat, about 70% of the play you engage in is this rough and tumble play. Back in the 1960s, where there weren't these rules prohibiting children from engaging in this rough and tumble play as in the schoolyard, researchers went out there and actually counted how many times did you engage in rough and tumble play versus other forms of play. And in humans, where the kids are freely choosing, right, not chosen for them, but freely choosing, it's about 10%. So you're absolutely right. In humans, the importance attributed to this by the children themselves has diminished relative to rats. Okay? But added to that is that many of the other activities that children engage in tap into the same kinds of basic skills. They may do it in the context other than physically roughhousing. So some games, but again, games that are constructed by the kids themselves rather than constructed by somebody else for the kids, may engage some of the same elements. You've got to be fair. You've got to resolve moments of ambiguity. When we made up this rule, is that what you really meant, or is that what you really meant? And you've got to resolve that. So some of the same things are involved in both. And again, the important thing is that when you look at the brain areas that are involved in regulating this kind of play in rats, are the same brain areas that are engaged when people, children, engage in play, be it of the physical form or some of these non-contact forms. So it's tapping into the same, but you're absolutely correct. There's some special features that you've got to pay attention to in humans that you can't see in rats. So you do have to be careful in just making a simple translation. Thank you.
I'm Howard Forsyth. Two words. Somebody said analogy, and you just said you had to be careful, so that scared me. There are a lot of analogies. Mohammedans are so sure that their God is so superior, so there's no... The term I like was reciprocal. That's not reciprocal. Wealth and rich and poor is a blot on civilization. That's not reciprocal. Maybe we can learn what you call social competence in the face of rich and poor, in the face of fantastic ideas about whose God is the real one. Almost any analogy that sets very wide gaps violates what you suggest as healthful learning, doesn't it?
True. The problem is that depending on the society you live in will determine how valuable these sorts of subtle social skills you acquire. Certainly if you're living in a very hierarchical society where you're at the top of the heap, basically you don't have to be sensitive to reading other people's social signals. You don't care. So it doesn't matter that you don't play because you're still dominant. However, in other societies, such as the one we live in, where it's more egalitarian, you can't just bully somebody into giving you what they want. There are rules, there are laws, there are accepted ways of doing it. So you have to be more sensitive to, oh, am I pushing Newt a bit too far here? And he's looking sternly at me, so I'm going to back down a little bit, right? Those social cues become important. So in some societies, more open ones, I think the opportunity to more subtly develop these social skills is more important, which is why I think denying our children the opportunity to engage in these sorts of activities is in fact not doing them a service.
I would even mention male-female. Males dominate, create most of the problems.
That's not healthy, is it?
I agree, it's not healthy, yes. I have to agree. My wife will have something to say about that.
Ruth Alzinger, perhaps Howard has preempted my thought, and that was basically you have given us some examples of dominant male rats and subordinate male rats, and I couldn't help but reflect upon the article I read in the paper this morning about some road rage where someone was cut off and followed this gentleman for 2 miles and or 2 kilometers and then took out his gun and started firing. So then in the back of my mind I'm thinking, well, I don't want to give someone who can't handle those situations, road rage for example, gosh, didn't they play nice when they're kids, or didn't play enough, or are we going to have some legal cases here?
Well, that's a very interesting example, because that actually touches on the issue of, well, Rembo talked a lot about the prefrontal cortex, but what is it actually doing? How is it involved in this behavior? Well, one of the important roles that the prefrontal cortex has is basically to inhibit you from doing something. So essentially, when I get really mad, before I scream obscenities at you, that little bit of my cortex say, just wait 10 seconds, let's analyze this before we actually act, right? Impulse control. This system is designed to downplay impulsive behavior. Damage this area, you're impulsive. You can't inhibit. Don't play. And in fact, there's some really good work that's been done by a Canadian psychologist, Richard Tremblay, in Quebec. And what he's shown is that, in fact, people are the most aggressive at about 2 years of age. You've all heard of, you know, you've all experienced the terrible twos. Well, it's true. And the basic problem is that they simply do not have impulse control over their aggressive emotions. Part of what trains them to be less impulsive is that when they interact with other kids, if they're too impulsive, too aggressive, the other kids will ostracize them. They won't play with them anymore. And so they learn to tone down. That's also been shown in monkeys, the same kind of process. So in fact, that there is more impulse control problems in the world, I would attest to more poorly developed frontal cortex, and a contributor to that is not having played enough.
I should have said Americans are trying to dominate the world. That's sick too, isn't it?
I don't think you're going to get an argument amongst Canadians.
I won't field that one, even though I'm a dual citizen. But anyway, we can't take questions from the floor, but certainly there's room, time for a few more questions. I've never seen SACPA members short of questions before. Thank you.
My name's Pat Greenlee. At our table, we were discussing the fact that girls, little girls do less rough and tumble play than little boys, and more verbalizing and solving difficulties verbalizing, and yet little girls seem to have a very good capacity for reading situations and maybe being more intuitive than little boys do. So how does that work?
Again, this is a good crowd, getting good questions here. My wife and I wrote most of our book, and right at the last chapter, we sort of looked at each other, you know, we may have just made a fundamental blunder. The very issue that Pat just raised, what's all this play any good for if little girls play less and they're socially smarter than little boys? That makes no sense. Now, and that doesn't only occur in little boys and little girls, it continues into adulthood. I'm sure you've all experienced the fact that if you're a guy in here, you probably know this. You know, you meet somebody new, you go to a dinner party, and you come away feeling, oh, they're nice people. And your wife says, boy, what a bunch of losers, they were horrible. Where'd that come from? And then, you know, a few more times you encounter those people, geez, she was right. Yeah, so it is true, and scientific studies have shown that women are generally more socially competent than men. So what's going on here, given that it's also scientifically been shown that given the choice, little boys will do more of this than little girls. So what's going on? Well, it turns out, again,
we don't know this for humans, but we'll try not to stretch the analogy too far, but at least the rats give us a bit of a clue. In this part of the brain, the way it's organized is already more like the socially competent type of brain in rats, irrespective of whether they play or not. So if you imagine sort of two levels, let's start equal here. At the beginning, before there's any play, little female rats are already more competent in terms of how their frontal cortex is organized. Okay? Then there's a minimum amount of play by both of them, and they both go up. In order to get the boy rats, to be closer to female performance in social competence, they've got to do more play. Now, why is that? Why should girls start off more socially competent than boys? Well, one thing that's true of all mammals in the world is that the primary caregiver for children is the mother. You can't afford to have an incompetent rat mother that's based on her social competence to detect and respond to the right signals from their children based on how much play they had. So their brain's already biased to be more socially competent. And then play can add on to that.
It's already in the DNA, how are we sure?
DNA depends on context, experience, for whether it's expressed or not. So you can't change the DNA, but you can change the context which will express that information.
Bob Anderson. Just three quick observations. One, I assume that you were talking about free play when you talked about their own choice and so on. So what you're discussing is really self-initiated, what we call free play. Secondly, is there some advantage to the physical contact, the physical activities, the roughness of that as opposed to the gentleness of that? Does it have some relationship to health in terms of the actual physical activity and physical encounters? And thirdly, have you excluded all other factors that account for adult social competency? Maybe there's a whole bunch of other things enter into that that you're not studying and maybe account for it much more so than free play.
Thank you. Again, great questions. So the first one is absolutely. I'm talking about freely chosen play. What do you do if you're given the opportunity to do what you want? Clearly, in a social context, what you want to do has to be negotiated with whoever is in that social group. So it's not completely free, because if somebody else doesn't want to play with you that way, then you've got to figure out how can I engage in play. But at least it's free to the point that it's not dictated by somebody else, like a computer game or a teacher. The second question, I just lost it. Physical, thank you. Physical activity. Certainly, as you saw from the rats and you saw from the young boys trying to kick one another, there's a lot of physical action going on in those encounters. And no one's quantified this. I don't know how much it would contribute, say, to growing trends of obesity amongst children, but certainly taking more and more opportunities for physical activity away from children certainly is not going to help. So my guess is that this would act as a counter to some of the trends that are inducing young children to become more obese at a younger age. And I think the other thing you mentioned is touch and physical movement in terms of stimulation. Well, it is true that there is an age-related preference for stimulation. And again, for those of you who had children, or for those of you who remember when you were children, a very popular thing to do is this.
You're doing that when you fall over, right?
What are you doing? You're stimulating the balance system in your inner ear, in your middle ear. And what you see is how much stimulation of that middle ear do do young animals do? Quite a lot, and then it decreases as you get older, and eventually you're not so interested. So getting that kind of stimulation seems to be important early on. Now, for touch, there's something special about touch. That's been known now for a while, and indeed a lot of nursing homes and so on have instituted this, that it's known that, you know, if you're lonely, an old person, lonely, had a stroke, some other things that are not making them work properly, a very good therapy is pet therapy. Give them a cat to stroke. And touching the cat, stroking it, what it does is it releases chemicals in the brain that stimulate the pleasure centers, that make you feel calm, relaxed, and happy. It also makes the cat feel good. So it's both pleasurable to do the stroking and pleasurable to receive the stroking. And again, it seems that in these rough and tumble things where there's a lot of touch going on, that touching is also activating these same pleasure centers that make the experience very positively reinforcing. And if you engage in somebody in a way that makes you feel good, then you're going to remember them in a very happy light. If you do these things with somebody that gives you bad experiences, you're going to remember them in a very negative light. So I think that the touch component can be very important, which is why I think even though in human children, freely chosen rough and tumble only constitutes about 10% of their total amount of play, it probably still provides an essential touch component that if you remove it, can't be substituted in other ways, even though you may be able to substitute other things. Was there a third part that I missed?
Other variables.
Absolutely. I've just been touching on rough and tumble play because I started off my scientific career wondering, why do animals engage in this behavior? Right? It was a puzzle. So I focused on that puzzle, and in the process, what you do is you try to eliminate other confounding variables, such as, well, just lying up against your mother is also an important component of developing social competence. Sitting down and, if you're a primate, grooming somebody else is a very important social experience. So there are lots of other ones, and I'm not saying that it's rough and tumble play or nothing, but at least experiments done with rats suggest that it is a major important component of the matrix of experiences that you need to have in order to build social competency. So it's one of the important ones, not the only one that's important.
Thank you. They've been very excellent questions. I think we have time for one more. Yeah.
If I may be permitted another question. I'm going to carry on with a topic that Howard Forsyth brought up earlier, and that is this matter of the separation of people in our society by the factor of wealth. Before he died, one of the last statements that Mahatma Gandhi made was that the greatest violence to human being is poverty. I would have liked him to have added to that, and wealth. I think that wealth does as many bad things to most of us as does poverty. What I'm referring to is the fact that children growing up in a society where the redistribution of wealth is being accelerated all the time, where the rich are growing rich much more rapidly and the poor are growing poorer more rapidly than ever before, our children being isolated from other playmates that are outside of their economic level. I've seen that right here in Lethbridge. I grew up here in Lethbridge, and it was true then, and it's much truer today. And isn't the artificial thing of our economic system, which dates back to the Middle Ages, now during this technological explosion that we're having, outdated, that we're permitting that much redistribution of wealth and the great gap between the wealthy and the poor, which separates people and prevents the playfulness and all the other intercourse that occurs between children at all ages and certainly adults as well?
Well, if that's the last question, what a doozy. That's well beyond the realms of my knowledge and expertise, so you'll just have to accept my opinion rather than informed research. So my opinion is that rough and tumble play,
because remember, it has to fulfill those two components that I showed you at the beginning: fairness and ways of resolving ambiguity. It means that if you got two kids of different status, because one comes from a rich family, one comes from a poor family, and they want to play together, they basically have to meet on common ground. So I view it as an equalizer. Your extra wealth is not going to buy you extra brownie points on being unfair. The other kid will not play with you. Similarly, I think that this kind of rough and tumble play can also be very valuable in having... Sorry, got a hair in my mouth. also may be very important as a vehicle by which people of kids from different ethnic or religious backgrounds can find common ground to interact on the same, using the same basic rules. And so I think that it could be one of the ingredients that would tend to counter the sense of I'm different to them, and not only am I different, I'm better. Because if I want to engage them, I've got to do exactly the same thing as they do.
I'm just curious. My name is Sylvia Campbell. I'm curious because of the perception in society and among teachers and parents that there is a growth or an increase in the amount of hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder. And I'm wondering whether you see any relationship to this period in life when rough and tumble play should take place.
Again, an excellent question, and I can't answer it with what I know, but I can try to answer it in the context of work that's been done by others, and not strictly in the context of rough and tumble play, but another phenomenon which I alluded to right at the beginning, which is not only are many school districts abolishing the opportunity for any contact forms of play, but also abolishing recess altogether. That is, having moments of time distributed through the day where the kids are let out in the schoolyard, they go mad for a little bit, and then they come back in. And there's some very good comparative studies looking across different countries which show that, in fact, countries, and Japan's one of them, that have a higher frequency of recess times distributed through the day is correlated with improved academic performance. Right? Now, taking that, now thinking about what a 5 or 6 year old or 7 or 8 year old is like, being told to sit still for 2 hours is hard. Asking them to sit still for 4 hours or 6 hours is next to impossible. And so you're going to get fidgety, your mind's going to wander elsewhere, and from an adult's point of view, who's not like that, they go, well, this kid is not paying attention. He's got attention deficit disorder. So I think that that is an artifact of the context we're putting a lot of kids. That's not to say that some kids actually do have those as pathological problems, but the growth in these problems, I think, is because of the context we put the kids in rather than anything intrinsically wrong with their brains.
Well, I'd like you to join me in thanking Sergio for discussing a very interesting topic today. Thank you, Sergio, very much for coming. And I'd also like
to comment that this is one of the most profound sessions we've ever had. What do you think?
Thank you, Howard. Your participation has been terrific. We thank you very much for coming, and especially for getting so involved in the session.
If I could just add, thank you very much to all of you for both inviting me and giving me a lot of food for thought. I'm sure that my students and I will be discussing some of the things that were raised here next week in our class.